Welcome, everyone, to today's installment of Heather Reads, the podcast. I am Heather, your host, and today we take a peek at a royal conundrum with a selection from the Harlequin Presents series. Our novel today is Crown Prince's Bought Bride by Maya Blake. It was published on February 19th, 2019, and I do kind of remember that day in the bookstore. I was trying to work up the courage to actually buy one of these, and the titles weren't exactly jumping out at me. Probably what cinched my choice for this particular novel was the back blurb that featured the words, Cinderella Waitress. I actually quite enjoy fairy tales, if the full collections of Hans Christian Andersen and Grimm Brothers on my bookshelf were any indication, so I thought that I might connect with that association. Is that what actually happened? Well, we'll get to that. As for the author, Maya Blake seems to be a staple of the Harlequin Presents series. She lives in England, which I kind of find interesting given that Harlequin is located in North America. Something that American readers might notice is certain notations inside the book. If you aren't familiar, quotation marks in England are notated with a single comma rather than the double comma in America. There's a couple of other quirks, but that's the biggest difference if you aren't used to it. And I have to say, I kind of like it, this difference. It's more than likely a cost and labor-saving measure, as well as streamlining distribution logistics. But hey, why waste time removing tiny dots of ink, right? Going to Maya Blake's website will reveal a few more of her titles, including A Diamond Deal with the Greek and The Sultan Demands His Heir. These type of titles, ones that feature racial and geographic specifics, seem to be a trend in the Present series and not just in Blake's books. Though one of her titles, Pregnant at Acosta's Demand, has earned itself a very concerned eyebrow raise. But today is about The Crown Prince's Bought Bride. The cover displays a round illustration featuring a man and a woman. Big surprise, I'm sure. They're standing in what looks to be a very extravagant hotel room, but it seems to be poorly lit. The woman is wearing a gold backless dress, and I'm not sure what that chain is in the middle of her back. It's like a statement necklace, but she's wearing it backward. And the man, who I assume is our prince, looks kind of gangly. He's got a typical romantic outfit on, button-down dress shirt, black slats, massive watch, 5 o'clock shadow, the usual. I don't know, he doesn't really seem to exude any special qualities besides the uniform, and he definitely doesn't look anything like the way I imagined the prince in my head when I was reading. I imagine him thicker, not necessarily in a muscular way, just not as skinny as the guy on the cover. At the top of the illustration in gold letters are the words, conveniently wed. I've got no idea how a wedding is convenient in any shape or form, but hey, it's a fantasy, right? In terms of the word convenient, I wouldn't consider it terribly appealing when applied to my wedding, personally. If I, the woman of this story, was told that I must marry this individual as a means to solve their problems, then I wouldn't be really enthused about the potential partnership. But I do realize what the story is going for. Oh, I'm this devastatingly handsome billionaire prince who needs a wife right now, and you are the woman upon which I choose to lavish my riches and status. But all that aside, our story begins with Prince Ramirez Alexander Montegova of the Kingdom of Montegova. The fantasy nerd in me really can't help but wonder about the name, and why the royal family shares it with their country. It's kind of a chicken and the egg question. Was the Kingdom of Montegova already there, and the current family who sits on the throne took the name to legitimize their invasion and takeover, or was the country brutally ransacked by an ancestor named Montegova who named it after he claimed the nation as his own? The world may never know. At any rate, our Prince Remy, as he's nicknamed, has a problem. His mother is stepping down as queen and needs him to succeed her. Thanks to some silly infidelity nonsense perpetrated by his late father, this kingdom is temporarily running on princess diary rules a la Disney, so he needs to secure himself a wife. And he's got to do it in 3 months. Whoo, boy, nothing says that this guy is a wise and competent king like a sudden and surprise marriage. This would, of course, be a lot for anyone's plate, but he has another task. He has to fly to London to extract his illegitimate half-brother Jules from this absolute trollop that has been plastered all over the tabloids. Now, Jules really only serves two purposes in this story. One, to establish how much of a scoundrel the late king was and why Remy is being pushed to get married before his coronation. And two, to get Alpha Male A into the arms of Take Me Now, Female B. And who is our heroine to be? Why, it's his half-brother's tabloid trollop. Yes, indeed. Before ever meeting her, Remy has already completely made up his mind about this woman. The way she is described is particularly telling. Dark blonde, leggy, bright green eyes, and a figure designed to stop traffic. She was striking, and her smile would win a contest against a 1,000-watt bulb. His gaze tracked her pert little nose, her wide, sensual mouth, cheekbones sculpted by a master craftsman, and a delicate jawline designed to be worshipped with fingers and lips. The sleek line of her neck dropped to slender, lightly tanned shoulders. Her collarbones were revealed by a sleeveless top, drawing attention to her soft throat and the impressive swell of her breasts. A flat, toned stomach, rounded hips, and those endless legs completed the package. Woof. An impressive description of our heroine, to say the least. But in the middle of the visual tour of her assets, Remy takes care to inform us that she was a dime a dozen in his world. Oh man, here I thought our girl was something special. And let's not forget that he takes a moment to wonder how good she is in bed. Oh, her! A stranger he's never met and already cast aside as not special and a gold digger to boot, who is clearly involved with his half-brother, and here he is, fantasizing how she might be in bed. This guy's the crown prince. Surely the one person you'd expect to have some sort of restraint when presented with a photo of a woman he's never met, and who is, for all intents and purposes, not even available to him relationship-wise. Yeah, he's a real winner. Along with all of this, I can sense a trope of romance nosing around, the damaged romantic interest. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a huge fan of this particular description, but I'm still at a loss as how else to call the trope of alpha male is actually carrying some serious emotional baggage that will add unnecessary drama, but exists to give our story some conflict that will ultimately be resolved by the heroine's love. Said damage is the death of his fiancée 2 years ago. We don't know what happened to her, only that she's died, and that he's been harboring guilt and grief over her death. Which is fine, but I don't think they have much therapy in Montegova, since the way it's written makes it feel like she died weeks ago rather than years. But hey, everyone processes grief differently. Some folks just wait around for a pretty girl to heal them instead of seeking professional advice. Anyway, so what of our heroine? Why is she intertwined with the half-brother of our alpha hero? She is Madeline Myers, a 24-year-old college dropout waitress who used to apparently be very rich. The back of the book describes her as Cinderella Waitress, like I mentioned before, but I feel like she has more in common with Beauty from Beauty and the Beast. A lot of the parallels line up really well. Her father was a wealthy man, made some bad business deals that plunged the family into poverty, and Mama's completely out of the picture. However, Maddie's father took his fall from grace exceedingly hard and turned to an addiction that wrecked his kidneys. And it is the kidney problem that leads us to Maddie's predicament. Because her father is an addict, the NHS won't provide him with a kidney transplant. So now she has to work to try and save up money for a private transplant all the way up in France. Full disclosure here, on my first read through, this confused me a little bit. The book doesn't immediately let on that his health was a result of self-destructive habits. I, being an American, thought to myself, Wait, don't they have the NHS in England? Why does she need to resort to getting the procedure in another country? But as we get further in, the addiction complication is revealed to us, and hence why NHS won't cover the surgery. And so this is where we find Maddie, down on her luck, dirt broke, and trying to save money for her father. It would be absolutely terrible if her situation became any worse. Which, of course it does. Aforementioned half-brother and ultimate royal pain, Jules Montegova, hits poor Maddie with a supercar. And really, when the Harlequin Presents series promised high-class lifestyles, I was not expecting the celebrity car crash to be included. Instead of having any compassion or concern like a normal human being and taking her to the hospital, Jules instead decides to buy her silence with the exact amount of money her father needs for the transplant, so long as she poses as his girlfriend. He neglects to tell her that he's related to royalty, and she's basically subject to his whims if she wants to be paid. I don't know about you, but I'm not sure I like where this is going. But fear not, dear listener, because it's Remy to the rescue. He's tracked Maddie and Jules down to a nightclub in Soho, and we get a whiff of that other trope, the romantic interest described as divine. The man who sauntered forward and paused under a golden spotlight nearly caused Maddie to swallow her tongue. Frozen in place, she stared unashamedly, certain that the faint tendrils of artificial smoke and strobe lighting were causing her to hallucinate the sheer magnificence of the godlike creature before her. But no, he was flesh. And I guess being British must give folks royal detection powers, because she's able to peg him in an instant for being some kind of nobility. I don't know about you, but I would just see a guy trolling around with his bodyguards and think that they're all just good friends out to lunch before they commit some financial fraud. While Maddie is simultaneously enchanted by Remy's dominating figure and becoming increasingly aware that she is seriously out of her depth, Jules is handled and made to leave the club, but not before he assaults Maddie with possibly the least romantic kiss in the history of all kisses. And after Jules is sent to bed without his supper, Remy asks Maddie to leave the club with him, and by asks, I mean use his position and bodyguards to bully Maddie into getting into his car. Boy, nothing like being stranded in a club full of strangers and pressured with the threat of physical violence to go with an unknown man to get me all hot and bothered. Whew! Once they're in the car, Remy lays out the situation for her, that Jules is his brother, their royalty, insinuates that he considers her to be a gold digger, and drops that he knows basically everything about her thanks to some background checks. And if I were in Maddie's shoes, this would be about where I would hope that maybe someone might find my body eventually. To his credit, he does try to prove that he is not a threat, albeit by attempting to offer whatever money Jules was paying her, but she does manage to call him out for his bodyguard enforcement. You can say what you want about Maddie, but you've got to hand it to her. She is not afraid to tell this guy where to put it, bodyguards aside. Thankfully, he drops Maddie outside her home, and she's left to figure out what the heck just happened. She was berated, bullied, basically kidnapped, and yet somehow she still felt aroused by Remy's presence. I am also confused about that, so I guess she's not alone. This is where we see Maddie's situation in full light. Her father's addiction, the mom abandonment backstory, her efforts to raise money. It's not a good place, and if I were Maddie, I'd be desperate to change my circumstances as well. How convenient that she finds herself crossing paths with an insanely wealthy prince. But this continues to be an entire theme in this book, one of destitution and rescue. I'm not all the way hip to the big romance tropes, but I suspect this is a popular one. It's probably because, especially for those in my generation, we like to imagine what it would be like for someone to swoop in, sweep us away, and erase all of our financial worries. This situation, however, where Maddie is desperate enough to the point where she's extorted to draping herself over a strange man, consequences be damned, doesn't exactly lay a foundation for an equal partnership. Yeah, erotic fiction is meant to blur the lines of reality and fantasy, as well as blur the lines of consent, and yeah, people find it entertaining and even fulfilling. But from my perspective, it would be really hard to have any attraction to a guy who's already labeled me a gold digger, who clearly doesn't respect me or my choices, and has his assumptions all confirmed when I accept his offer for more money. That's Maddie's choice. Let this guy think I'm trash, and allow him to walk all over me, or walk away and accept that my father will likely fall back into addiction and die. I know I'm supposed to be charmed by Remy, by his good looks and his wealth, but he's created a situation where Maddie is totally dependent on him, and can't possibly refuse anything he orders her to do. At any rate, on the next day we follow Maddie to her job, but so does Prince Remy. She's been close to panicking all morning that she's blown her one good chance at helping her father, but it looks like Remy isn't done with her yet, and he demands that she walk away from her job to speak with him. Risking her employment, she reluctantly follows him into his car again and is told that she won't be associating with Jules any longer. Full-blown panicking ensues when she believes the money that she needs is gone. However, Remy tells her that it is possible to salvage whatever arrangement she had. Maddie doesn't explain why she needs the money, and despite his boasted background checks, Remy doesn't seem to fully understand what's going on with her. But she finally blows up at him for his behavior and explains that she got into the whole mess in the first place because Jules had hit her with his car. This will now prompt Remy to add a second kidnapping attempt to his record, where he orders the driver to take her to a hospital against his will. To his credit, when Maddie complains about his nonsense again, he tells her that he's doing this only out of royal duty to protect his family. He does finally ask her to come with him of her own free will, and she agrees, but let's be honest, Remy's idea of free will isn't actual free will. During all of that, we get some insights into Remy's perspective. Maddie looks nothing like his dead fiancé, but she keeps evoking her memory. And on top of that, he's struggling with the desire to have sex with her. Oh yes, she's beautiful, like so many women he's known, but something about her is alluring. And that's another trope that we see pretty much everywhere, the undefined something. That intangible quality that makes the heroine just so irresistible to our alpha male that he can't help himself but fawn all over her. I'm willing to guess that this is on purpose, to help readers put themselves in the place of the heroine so that they could imagine catching the attention of an impossibly handsome suitor. All enchantments to the side, Remy gets her to a private clinic, which of course becomes justified because she had actually sustained more serious injuries than just some bruises. Once it's all finished, Remy takes her, not back to her job, oh yeah, she is definitely fired by that point, but to his hotel room at the Four Seasons. Oh, did I say hotel room? I meant the penthouse that they permanently rent from the Four Seasons with a private and secure entrance so Maddie can't run. The two go back and forth for a while, Maddie demanding that he let her go and Remy demanding that she stay. He finally wins by convincing her that she doesn't really have a choice, since he's royalty and anything he says goes. Like a proper Prince Charming. He offers her basically the same deal that Jules had, just this time with a lot more money, so that she would spend time with him. But he would also require her to sign an NDA and accompany him to Montegova when he returns home. And I'm not really sure what to make of this. I feel like in normal circumstances, he would see to Maddie's injuries, pay her off, get the NDA, and leave. The only real solid reason we get is that he wants to be certain that she doesn't mean his family any harm, or at least that's what he tells her. He keeps having his own thoughts about her, ranging from curiosity to full-blown lust. Maddie is still trying to keep some secrets, and admits to him that she can't really just leave England and her father behind. She doesn't let on about his illness, but she just says that she can't leave. Remy relents a little bit, allowing her some time to consider his offer. But if she accepts his terms, she returns that evening to the penthouse to sign the NDA and attend a gala with him, beginning their arrangement. With that, he drops her off at home again, where she contemplates the choice before her: agree to the prince's terms or possibly lose her father. But of course, in the end, she returns to the penthouse, signs the NDA wearing a dress of his choosing, and they attend this grand galloping gala where they attempt to appear like a normal couple. And that's how our romance starts. Remy taking advantage of poor Maddie, and Maddie having to endure snide insults and playing as the prince's ornament for the sake of her father. Remy does kiss her on this night, and it's all she can do to protest at being grabbed and kissed by two Montegoven brothers now. Now, I suppose I've made it sound like Maddie is completely unwilling in this story, but that's not really fair. When the narration's following her inner monologue, we are made privy to her desires, and she does not find Remy unattractive. Insufferable, bossy, threatening, but not unattractive. We see the Beauty and the Beast parallels pop up again. Maddie is essentially trapped in Remy's home, or rather penthouse, I suppose, if she wants to save her father's life. She's thrust into the world of royalty and glamour while begrudgingly giving her company to a man with massive baggage. And one could say that Remy is cursed, though more it's really just a past that follows him. There's a half-brother caused by his father's betrayal and infidelity, and a dead woman who he planned to make his queen. And, like our Beast of Yore, Remy must take a lover, a wife, so that he can finally move forward towards his future. Unlike the Beast, however, Remy seems to see Maddie really more as a means to an end rather than a partner who could love him. He's racked with guilt when he's overcome with lust for Maddie, and he's wondering how far he can push her in terms of their agreement. Indeed, after they kiss, Remy towers over Maddie, but still verbally reminds her that their association is purely business.
What are you doing? She whispered under her breath. The overwhelmingly male figure before her smiled, and a hand she didn't recall releasing her joined the other at her waist in a firm hold. Extending the parameters of our association, he said. I don't recall agreeing to this.
Remy assures himself that he sees no other use in Maddie, except to protect his family, no matter how strangely he's going about it. And if he's lucky and has sex with her, he can go back to not being consumed with lust whenever he looks at her and resumes his princely duties. And this is what leads us to the strangest part of this novel. Maddie, having asked for an advance on payment and a moment to see her father, irritated Remy by being late with a turned-off phone. While he chastises her for making him think that she'd done a runner, he becomes overwhelmed with his infatuation for her. And finally, nearly halfway through a supposed erotic romance novel, we are confronted with our very first potential sex scene. Except, wet blanket moment incoming, Maddie reveals herself to be a virgin. I want to be very clear here. There is nothing wrong with being a virgin. There is nothing wrong with wanting to stay a virgin. And there is certainly nothing wrong with sex with a consenting partner outside of marriage. But man, Remy's reaction is, well, I'll let him speak for himself.
He reared back as if he'd been shot, expelling a stunned breath as he stared down at her. Tell me why you're 24 and still a virgin, he demanded, his gray eyes almost black with stormy desire.
Like, it's almost shameful at her age? How dare she tempt him and still be a virgin? I haven't read much romance at this point, but the few I have read didn't have this strange quirk of a plot. Well, there's the one, and I can't help but wonder if that book influenced the author's choice to make Maddie a virgin. But fear not, dear listener, if you were worried about Maddie becoming compromised, Remy has it covered.
Be calm, my beautiful innocent. I'll safeguard your treasure, he muttered thickly.
You'll pardon me a moment so that I can hurl. Oh, I think that this is more indicative of our cultural attitude towards women and their sex lives, rather than any actual fetish or wish fulfillment.
well, maybe some wish fulfillment, considering the fact that a lot of women, myself included, were told that the moment we entered into a sexual encounter with a man, our bodies are forever ruined, and therefore less desirable to the men who may want to marry us one day. So, even though Maddie is sexually attracted to Remy, she can't really allow herself to act upon those feelings. It's just so convenient that Remy is attracted to her as well and has placed her in an arrangement where she really can't say no. That pressure of societal expectations is lifted. And that's all my own interpretation, by the way. I don't recall parts of the text where Maddie slut-shames herself, but I'm very familiar with that fantasy of having the ability to say no removed so society doesn't punish us too much. So going back to our story, Remy and Maddie have their very first erotic encounter, but one that could be arguably classified as not sex. And honestly, the conversation about what constitutes sex and sexual encounters goes far beyond the capacity of this podcast. But I am curious to see if this is a trope that holds up in future books. After they settle down and chat, Remy goes to get showered when Maddie gets a call from a neighbor that her father had gotten into a bottle of painkillers, thus shooting any attempt of his recovery and life-saving surgery in the foot. She runs out of the penthouse without telling Remy to stop whatever damage she could. Remy, of course, reacts very rationally and immediately demands the security team take him directly to her and gets all sorts of worked up. When he arrives at her house, we get some more inner monologue about how awful it is that such a beautiful creature has to languish in such squalor, alongside a spoken comment that she'd better not have abandoned him for another man's bed. I mean, if that's what you really think about her, Remy, just tell us, jeez. But now Maddie has no choice to be completely honest. She gives him the situation with her father, her desperate attempts to get the money she needs to save his life, all to his horror. And what does our dear Remy do? Does he insist that she care for her father in the immediate moment and take some time to really evaluate her circumstances? Does he offer full or partial payment to help Maddie get her feet under her? No, of course not. He sees an opportunity. Because at the gist of it, what Remy needs is a wife if he wants to satisfy his mother and become king. And here is a woman who has already demonstrated that she will do anything to make her father well again. It's just like the worst kind of extortion. He basically says, hey, I'm going to give you everything you need to save your father's life, giving him top class private care. All you have to do is marry me. I mean, I kind of wish that Maddie had her own personal goals or problems, more internal motivation. It could still be, like, impossibly hard, sure, something that feels inescapable, but she could be more motivated for herself than for someone else. Remy has no qualms about using her to solve his problems, but I suppose it's meant to showcase how selfless she is, rather than being motivated by her own self-interests. I understand that the line between motivated and selfish can be really hard to walk, but if she had something other than her father's life on the line, her agreement could feel less like she's trading her freedom into a life of gilded slavery. So Maddie's dad is whisked away to a private clinic somewhere in Europe, Switzerland, I think, so he can begin his treatment, and Maddie again returns to the hotel. Remy tells her that in no uncertain terms, their marriage is one of convenience, completely free of emotion and purely transactional. However, Maddie must still perform as if they're desperately in love whenever they're public. But then, after all of that speech, he kisses her, passionately. I mean, I guess he was trying to prove that he won't be a total ogre to her, but, like, it feels like he's still getting her hopes up with a very sensual moment. Like, that's not gonna backfire at all. They fly off to Montegova, and it's all a whirlwind from there. Maddie meets the queen, which is just as uncomfortable as you'd expected it to be, and now the wedding plans can begin to take place. And we keep getting this emotional whiplash. in between being introduced to the Montegoven public and letting her past all out in the open to get ahead of any scandals, and preparing for that wedding in just 5 weeks, Remy is rigidly cold around her behind closed doors while mooning all over her in public. And then if, to make things worse, Maddie keeps finding reminders of Celeste, you know, Remy's dead fiancé, all over the palace. The day before her wedding, Maddie will challenge him on his coldness. And honestly, I gotta give it to her again. She's gotta be stuck with this guy, but at least she's trying to stand up for herself. With all these reminders lurking about, she accuses him of wishing it were Celeste instead of her. And she tells him that he's probably still grieving. If anything, she's trying to give him a solid out for this marriage. That it's okay, he doesn't like her in any way, he can take his time. Of course, he takes offense to this because, sure, and gives her another insane, crazy kiss. But she still has her doubts. Even when she's standing at the altar, she wonders to herself if she'll be spending the rest of her life looking for any signs of Remy's attraction for her. And that's kind of the point where I think I gave up and just finally settled into the weirdness of this story. She prepares for their wedding night, and I really can't help but be captivated by a paragraph I thought I would never read. Her gaze slowly rose to meet Remy's. There was no going back. This was her wedding night, and if it was all she'd ever get, duty to the Montegoven crown or not, she would take it. Treasure the experience. She would give her virginity to her husband without trepidation or regret.
I guess you do you, boo. And here comes another trope that I am sure has existed for as long as white women have fantasized about foreign partners. Remy starts talking in whatever language Montegoven is supposed to be during their activities, and I'm not sure that's how language works. Sure, it's supposed to be sensual and exotic for fantasy purposes, but I'm willing to bet that this doesn't happen in real life the way it does in fiction. But I guess that's why it's fiction. Anyway, they have sex not once, but twice on this night. However, the second time is more spontaneous, and Remy forgets to use protection, heat of the moment and all that. But when he realizes this, the deed is already done, and he flips out. The book is careful at this point to note that they had discussed long-term family planning in the weeks leading up to the wedding, but decided against any solid decisions because they wanted to avoid potential side effects. I'd say that's valid, but only just. You're telling me that the royal family, who has an entire medical staff on call and several illegitimate heirs from a scoundrel king, doesn't realize that Plan B exists? Like, that's the entire point of Plan B. But really, Remy's freakout cycles around his carelessness. He was careless with Celeste, his words, and blames himself for the aneurysm that killed her. That's totally the same as getting his wife pregnant, right? Who would have been expected to carry his kids anyway? Honestly, I'm just really surprised that Remy just didn't go ahead and start shooting for kids right at the start. Get it out of the way. But then I guess we wouldn't have gotten the drama, heaven forbid. After that candle snuff of a wedding night, Remy leaves her alone in the honeymoon palace for 3 weeks until she demands to return to the capital city with him. She's been refusing to get a pregnancy test, but the staff have been treating her as if she's already pregnant and she's pretty much over it. Once back, she is subjected to a dinner with Remy's godmother. This really, in my opinion, just adds more unnecessary nonsense to the situation, because now, again, she's got to endure more snide remarks about her upbringing, and she's got to do it in a diplomatic fashion. And then when she gets hit with a bout of morning sickness and runs to the bathroom, she gets stuck overhearing the godmother and some other noblewoman snark more about her background, and then gets some bitterness that the godmother's daughter didn't end up as Remy's choice bride. If I wanted to read a book with high school tactics and drama, I would, you know, do that.
Before they go home, Remy and Maddie fight some more on a balcony, and then out of nowhere, they kiss. I guess? I am well and truly lost at this point. But back home, he pretty much tells her that it should not have happened. So we get more bickering, oh how romantic, and Maddie tells him that she is for sure she's pregnant. Before they can really discuss it further, however, she gets, a headache, and Remy, having already lost one spouse to a bad headache, freaks out again. He makes her take some medicine that's safe for both her and the baby, and she goes to bed. But, you know, he doesn't leave her alone for long. He barges into her room an hour later, demanding that they talk about their situation. And they do talk things out, because, of course, this is fluffy romance, and there has to be a happy ending. But it's really easy to see how it got this bad. Simple communication would have saved all of this way sooner. Remy could have just been honest about his trauma. Maddie could have been open about her family situation, all that jazz. For such a cautious guy, and for one who will be leading a country in a few months, and should be able to approach things calmly and confidently, Remy's pretty bad at this whole relationship thing. Anyway, they get their happily ever after, because this really wouldn't be a terribly satisfying ending if they didn't. There's even an epilogue, which I don't really feel really adds anything. All it shows is that Maddie is now 5 months pregnant, and Remy is fully crowned as king. Oh, and they're still desperately in love, of course. Yeah. So, to wrap up this review, the book is fine, I guess. I'd say that it was competently written, if the content isn't a bit strange. To be frank, this book is so much weirder than I expected it to be. I don't really know if I had any actual expectations, but I sure as heck was not expecting that. But I can see the escapism it offers, and I understand why it's attractive. 10 years ago, I would have loved a handsome prince practically dropping out of the sky to solve all my problems. I just felt like Maddie was coerced in the whole deal, and it made me uncomfortable. I also would have liked if our main characters had been a bit more defined beyond the characterization of two people who have sex sometimes. They really only saw each other as a means to an end, and not a lot of time is devoted to the relationship after the fact. If Remy had been a little less oppressive and Maddie less defensive, I probably would have enjoyed it more. But for folks who like high-class aesthetics and intercultural relationships with a dash of royalty, this might be a title to look into. With all of that said, it's time for Heather's final score. For the cover art, I'm going to give it a 2 out of 5. The featured couple are standing in a very static position, and not a lot of movement or chemistry is implied. The colors feel rather muted and cool for what was supposed to be a romantic book, but they do imply a luxurious feeling. Our drama score will be a 3 out of 5, mostly because I felt that it wasn't over the top enough to hit melodrama, but not serious enough for suspenseful romance, in that will-they-won't-they sort of way. We know they will, of course, because their choices were either sink or swim. On the world-building scale, I'm going to go ahead and give this a 2 out of 5. I appreciate that the author made her own nation and royal family, but I know almost nothing about Montegova. We're told that it's in Europe, that the language sounds like a mix of Italian and French, but that's it. I can't recall if the landscapers were described at all, and if it was, it really wasn't memorable. We aren't given any history or why the country is special. I'm not asking for a lot, but I know more about the fictional kingdom of Genovia from the Princess Diaries, and I haven't even read those books. For the romance, I'm giving another 2 out of 5, mostly because I'm uncomfortable with the fact that Maddie didn't have a lot of agency in this relationship, and because I'm not a huge fan about the way Maddie's virginity played a part. One could argue that this was an arranged marriage and that sex is secondary to all other considerations, but we're reading an erotic romance novel. Sex should absolutely happen more than once in the story. For my realism rating, this gets a 2 out of 5. The situation is pretty out there,
But I guess that might be what really sets apart the Present series from the other Harlequin titles. Maddie's situation skirts along the lines of completely ridiculous that it's hard for me to suspend my disbelief. And then she just happens to get hit by the one guy hanging out in all of England who can connect her with the prince that will solve all of her problems. And the fact that he decided to marry her instead of handling the situation quietly like most foreign diplomats would is another strike against it. It's not a terribly organic way for our two main characters to get together. In the end, I don't really have any serious feelings toward this book, and I'm a little unsatisfied. I do have hope that it won't always be this way, though, and that the perfect book for me is just waiting out there. For my final overall rating, I'm going to give it a solid 2 illegitimate princes out of 5. That's all for today, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I can't wait to have you back for Heather Reads the Podcast. Like the show? Please visit us at heatherreads.com for more. That's HEATHERREADS.com. If you have any questions or just want to say hi, you can email us at podcast@heatherreads.com. And remember, it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.